Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Coming up on the program today, corporate profits and this macro economy, what American trade policy right now means in actual practice, and kidnapping as a business model. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday today, the 30th day of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A word as we get going here, and that word is profits, corporate profits. It can be tempting on a day like today when we get earnings reports from, to name just a couple, GE, GM, McDonald's, MasterCard, and Apple. It can be tempting to read into them perhaps more than one should, to wonder whether they are telling us something about the economy writ large. You could give in to that temptation, but as Marketplace's Bree Benishore reports, you best not, because corporate profits are not the economic indicators you might want them to be.
There was a saying back in the day, you might have heard it.
What's good for GM is good for the United States.
Pete Earle is a research fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research. That saying is based on a quote by the CEO of General Motors back in 1953. He actually said, "What was good for our country was good for General Motors and vice versa." Anyway, that's not really always true today.
For example, we own Cummins.
William Smead is CEO of Smead Capital Management. Cummins is a builder of heavy equipment.
And Cummins had a very good report today. And Cummins is a very economically sensitive company, but they have a lot of their sales outside the United States.
Outside the United States, the country's biggest companies are multinational. They have footprints and tentacles all around the globe. How they are doing depends on a lot more than just the U.S. economy. And even within the U.S., earnings have much more to do with the individual struggles and disruptions of a particular industry or business model than the economy writ large. Also, earnings are slow to react to things like GDP growth, says Pete Earle.
Corporate earnings, they are something of a lagging indicator.
Plus, hello, it's not like corporations take truth serum when they report earnings. They don't tell you everything.
Firms can manage their accounts to satisfy analysts and investors.
Vince Reinhardt is chief economist with Mellon.
Corporate CEOs also manage their conversation in their earnings calls, put their firm in the best light.
That said, one way corporate earnings can be useful as a window into the economy is as an opportunity to listen to what CEOs are talking about, what they're worried about, what they expect from the future. But generally speaking, earnings, like markets, are not the economy. And the economy isn't a particular company's earnings. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
I've heard that somewhere before, that phrase. I don't know. Just saying. It is early days yet in the 2020 campaign, but it is safe to say, thinking just broad outlines of that campaign right now, that healthcare is going to be just near the top of the policy discussions that will be had. And that takes us to Capitol Hill, where a healthcare proposal championed by a bunch of Democrats, many of them running for president, got its first congressional airing today. Medicare for All is the policy, and you are going to be hearing about it a lot the next 553 days until Election Day. And seeing as how we spend $3.5 trillion on healthcare in this economy every single year, we figured a quick explainer was in order. Marketplace's Andy Euler has it.
At this point, the phrase feels ubiquitous.
It is time for Medicare for All.
The strengths of a Medicare for All program.
And we figure out how to do Medicare for All.
That's Representative Pramila Jayapal, whose bill got a hearing today, and Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
When people say Medicare for All, they don't mean that.
John Hollihan follows healthcare policy at the Ehrman Institute.
I think they mean something that would be more like a traditional health insurance plan, but run by the government.
He says that's because Medicare has grown really complicated over the years. Plans are broken into a bunch of different parts. Senator Sanders has a bill supported by Senator Warren. That bill would ensure all Americans have coverage and pay nothing out of pocket. The government would essentially replace private health insurance. Robert Polin at the University of Massachusetts Amherst says there's one common idea behind all the different proposals out there.
To provide good quality care for every resident of the country, and to do it in a way that achieves significant cost savings.
How does covering more people add up to cost savings? Polin says when you get rid of private insurance companies and transition to a single-payer system,
you reduce total administrative costs by 9% of the total system costs. That's big.
Polin says under Medicare for All, drug prices would also decrease because the government would have more bargaining leverage with big pharma. He also acknowledges that richer Americans will likely pay more in this system than they currently do. Robert Graybois at George Mason University doesn't think the proponents of a Medicare for All system have the math right.
You would have to more than double all personal and corporate income taxes immediately. That would be the largest tax increase in the history of the world.
A Congressional Budget Office estimate of Representative Jayapal's Medicare for All bill is expected on Wednesday. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer are in Beijing today getting set for the next round of trade talks with their Chinese counterparts. Those talks continue in Washington next week. But ever since the president's tariffs on Chinese imports and Beijing's retaliatory tariffs on American goods going over there went into effect last year, we have been asking small business owners in this country who are stuck in the middle of the disagreement between this world's two biggest economies how they're doing, basically. So today, some updates. First up, a guy who was in favor of those tariffs.
My name's Michael Korchmar. I'm the CEO of Korchmar, the leather specialty company, a 102-year-old manufacturing company. What I'm hoping as a, not just as a business owner, but primarily as an American, to see the issues between China and the U.S. resolved in an equitable manner so that tariffs are not necessary unless you're trading with someone who is not trading in good faith. The additional 10% tariffs on our products help considerably to move some business back to this side of the world. We've done a good bit of hiring. We've probably increased staff somewhere between 40 and 60 employees. And the challenge is balancing the future. So if our government's able to resolve this in a manner that forces them and allows it to be verified that they are trading in good faith, we would love to have access to the Chinese market without high duties and non-tariff barriers.
Michael Korchmar there of Korchmar Leather. A couple of more of our trade regulars coming up on Wall Street today. Just a tad more subdued than it's been. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Bree was talking economic indicators and how maybe corporate profits ain't. There was an actual indicator out today, a biggie in the big slice of this economy that is housing. The S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller National Home Price Index, better known as Case-Shiller, showed home prices for the month of February were up 4% from a year earlier, which is price growth, yes, but the 11th straight month of slower price increases. And as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, there are signs in some places we might just possibly, almost, kind of, sort of, could be headed into a buyer's market.
We know what a seller's market looks like because we've been in one for years, but a buyer's market?
You would actually get price cuts, homes would sit on the market longer, and gasp, in some markets, we might even see price decreases.
Ralph McLaughlin is deputy chief economist at CoreLogic. He says some markets like Seattle, San Francisco, and San Diego are already headed there, and the overall market may not be far behind.
We are still nationally in somewhat of a seller's market, but there are pretty strong signs that we're moving into neutral territory. And possibly by the middle or end of this year, we might be slightly on the buyer side.
So yeah, maybe, sorta, kinda. But buyers already have more power than they have in years. Daryl Fairweather is chief economist at the online brokerage Redfin.
Our buyers are having a much easier time getting their offers accepted, and they're actually spending less time looking for homes.
Plus, mortgage rates are down and wages are rising. There are also more homes on the market. But Skylar Olson, head of economic research at Zillow, says mostly because houses are taking longer to sell.
There are more leftovers from last month. So that's great for someone looking in the sense that it's a sign that there's less competition. But it's not necessarily the fact that it'll be easier to find the perfect match for you.
And a caveat for all those hoping for a real buyer's market, Olson says it will likely coincide with a recession. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Installment number two of what this era of U.S.-Chinese trade discontent means to those actually trying to run a business, and it comes to us from the owner of a women's handbag startup.
My name is Lisa Hu. Our company's name is Luxonix, and we are based in St. Louis, Missouri, and we designed functional bags for the women on the go. We had a strategy to go into wholesale this year, and as a result of the tariffs, that definitely is a consideration in terms of why we're not going full force on department stores. We actually ordered more inventory just to, one, compensate for a higher cost, as well as just in case there is another increase in tariffs. People always ask me, what are you going to do? And, you know, my response is really, I mean, there's nothing we can do. This is something, in a way, from a business owner standpoint, it's out of my control. I really do hope that from these negotiations that they decide to not put that kind of burden on the consumer. So far, I've decided not to pass on the burden of the cost to the customers, just from the standpoint of it's not the customer's fault.
Lisa Hu of Luxonix out of St. Louis, Missouri. Coming up.
If you have kidnapped for ransom insurance, you get help negotiating a ransom and making the transaction work.
A criminal enterprise regulated organically, like a regular business. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 38 today, about a 10%. 26,592 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 54 points, about 0.6%. 8,095. S&P 500 up 2, less than a tenth. 29.45 there. Alphabet tumbled 7.5% today. The parent company of Google posted slowest revenue growth in 3 years and thus missed expectations. Facebook down 0.7%. Healthcare stocks rallied. Pfizer up 2.5% today. The nation's biggest drug maker posted better than expected first quarter profit and raised its earnings forecast. General Electric sparked up 4.5% today. When was the last time you heard me say that? GE posted better than expected first quarter earnings and reaffirmed its forecast for 2019. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Some of the most expensive housing markets in this country have one very noticeable thing in common. Call it a corollary to location, location, location. All of them have a limited supply of land. Silicon Valley is at the base of a peninsula, water on two sides, mountains in between. Manhattan is literally on an island, as is Honolulu. To make housing a bit more affordable, lawmakers in Hawaii are going to try something developed on an island city across the Pacific. From Hawaii Public Radio, Ryan Finnerty reports.
It's an old joke that the crane should be the state bird of Hawaii, the construction crane. Standing in the Honolulu neighborhood of Ala Moana, you can see why. High-rise cranes dot the sky, each one working on a new building. From this street corner, at least three construction sites are visible. All of them are condo developments. I met realtor Tracy Yamato outside one of the projects.
For a two-bedroom, two-bath unit in a newer building, it could range anywhere from a low of $700 up to over $1 million.
Honolulu has some of the highest housing prices in the country. The median price of a single-family home is around $800,000. For a condo, it's more than $400,000. Sumner LaCroix is a research fellow with the University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization.
There's only two places in the country that have higher housing prices when I looked in February of 2019, and those two places are San Francisco and San Jose.
State and city laws require most new developments to set aside a certain percentage of units for affordable rental housing. But in 5 years, Honolulu is still projected to fall short of its target by more than 40,000 units. That has elected officials looking for other solutions to the problem in Singapore.
For more than half a century, the Housing and Development Board has been providing homes for Singaporeans, building homes of quality and value.
The housing program began actually after the Second World War.
That's Ho Chi Tim, a historian in Singapore. After World War II, a series of fires destroyed much of the city's housing stock. Thousands were left homeless. The government stepped in with a massive public housing program. These days, the vast majority of Singapore residents live in flats built by the government.
Definitely over 80%, 85, upwards of 85%.
That's more than 4 million people. Singapore residents can purchase a two-bedroom flat on the resale market for under $300,000. Hawaii State Senator Stanley Chang wants to replicate Singapore's program here in Hawaii.
I think it's important that if we're going to try to solve a problem, that we go to successful examples of where that problem has been solved.
Singapore fits five times the population of the island of Oahu, where Honolulu is located, into half as much space. In both cities, the median household income is about the same, just over $80,000.
We're proposing to provide abundant, affordable housing by developing state-owned lands with high-density units that would then be sold at cost with no taxpayer subsidy to Hawaii residents who own no other real property and who will be owner-occupants.
The initial construction costs would be funded by a bond issue or general state funds. The units could be passed down to children or sold. The state would tax 75% of resale profits. Chang's goal is to bring the units to market for around $300,000, which he says would cover the cost of construction. But economist Sumner LaCroix is skeptical.
The research that I've done doesn't really show that to be possible. When we look at recent city reports, they have the cost of developing affordable housing at $400,000 to $500,000. So how the state would sell at $300,000 is a bit of a mystery.
Hawaii lawmakers have appropriated $150,000 to study the plan before they consider it again next year. In Honolulu, I'm Ryan Finnerty for Marketplace.
Our trade policy reality check number three is from the logistics end of tariffs, imports, and exports.
My name is Gretchen Blau. I work for Logistics Plus Customs Brokerage Solutions in Erie, Pennsylvania. A lot of our time is spent, you know, reassuring customers, going over the classifications, the harmonized tariff schedules. You know, everyone wants to take a really good, hard, close look to make sure that everything is classified correctly so they are paying the correct tariff. The problem with that is adding any kind of staff to help out with that because there's a learning curve with this type of thing. It takes a special type of mentality, whether that's good or bad. I keep getting a lot of questions about, well, what do you think is going to happen? And unfortunately, I don't have a magic ball. So I really, you know, like a magic crystal ball to tell them anything. I'm hoping to see maybe a little bit of relief for our customers. Probably what I mean by relief isn't necessarily that the tariffs will necessarily go away, but a little bit of relief in that they can do some more long-term planning.
Gretchen Blau there with Logistics Plus in Erie, PA. We're going to do an interview now that is firmly rooted in the economic reality that there is a market for everything, legal or not. Kidnappings for ransom, criminal kidnappings of cargo ships or executives, for instance, are the stuff of corporate and personal nightmares. They are also, though, big business, to the tune of thousands of people a year kidnapped to be ransomed back to their families or employers. Thing is, and this is where the market forces come into play, most, or almost all, actually, of those people kidnapped do get home safely. Dr. Anya Shortland has studied the kidnap for ransom business. She is a reader in political economy at King's College London, and she has written it up in her book, which is called Kidnap Inside the Ransom Business. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
The thrust of this book, which was so fascinating, what we have here is an organically derived governance of a criminal marketplace, right?
That's exactly right. So what we have is a governance structure that helps people who operate normally in the legal economy to contract with people outside the legal economy, i.e. the criminal underworld.
The key, it seems to me, to this entire thing working are the insurance syndicates, right? The external forces who come in and say, this is what the boat is worth. This is what the situation is worth. We're not going to pay more than this. Without insurance companies, this market, in essence, falls apart.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, the problem with this particularly tricky trade is that for the family and for the ship owner and for the firm, this is a one-off transaction with a counterparty that you don't trust, that you don't know, that you know will cheat you. And the only thing that will keep them behaving and keeping to their promises is the shadow of the future, the fact that they want to do this again and again and again. So you need an infrastructure that collects the information about those counterparties that keep their promises and that punishes the counterparties that go rogue. And that information infrastructure, as you say, has been created by a number of syndicates at Lloyd's of London who sell kidnap for ransom insurance.
And it's only out of Lloyd's, right? I mean, Lloyd's is the big name, obviously, in sort of global insurance, and they're the ones. No, ain't nobody else.
That is right. But Lloyd's is a market.
Right.
So there are about 20 syndicates who are competing for kidnap for ransom insurance contracts. They underwrite them in the Lime Street underwriting room, which means that you've got a fantastic system for exchanging information, but doing so extremely discreetly.
So, I mean, when you say Lime Street underwriting room, are they all sitting in the same room, these insurers?
That is the fascinating thing about this market, that you've got a club of people who can cooperate, but who will also fiercely compete with each other for business.
Yeah. That competition thing is interesting. But look, on that subject of information, so these insurance brokers have all this information because they're sitting next to each other. On the other end of this trade, though, right, because that's what it is, on the other end of the trade are the kidnappers, the murky, don't necessarily play by the rules, aren't going to tell you what's really going on. So how do you deal with that information incompleteness and asymmetry?
So if you have kidnapped for ransom insurance, you get help negotiating a ransom and making the transaction work from very, very experienced crisis responders. And they collate that information that they have because ultimately a lot of these groups do this kind of thing over and over again. So over time, you know how they behave, you know what their expectations are, you can manage their expectations. That way, rather than having every ransom negotiation completely probing how much a particular person or boat is worth, you establish a ransom level. Everyone works towards that, and that makes it much easier to agree.
This is going to sound like a crazy thing to say, but the kidnap for ransom market actually works. Most of these hostages and the boats or whatever, they are actually returned, repatriated, and go on about their lives.
Absolutely. So that was the big puzzle that motivated my research, that if you're insured for kidnap for ransom, then 97.5% of hostages come back alive.
Wow.
How can that possibly be, given how fiendishly tricky it is to interact with a criminal counterparty? So that was my starting point. How does it work? And I looked at these processes, these institutions, all these agencies that tie up every loose end that there is in this fiendishly tricky process to make sure that people come back alive.
Anya Shortland is a reader in political economy at King's College London. An absolutely fascinating book called Kidnap, about the ransom business and the ransom market. Dr. Shortland, thanks very much for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
This final note on the way out today, a very brief dramatic reading of a presidential tweet, and then an equally brief discussion of what one can only assume would be the unintended consequences were that tweet to be put into action. The president, in the middle of a thing about the economy today on Twitter, said this of the Federal Reserve, quote, "We have the potential to go up like a rocket if we did some lowering of rates, like 1 point, and some quantitative easing." So look, you know how markets and analysts and, yes, sometimes economics reporters go kind of crazy when the Fed raises or lowers rates even a quarter of a point? A full percentage point interest rate cut right now would be A, really, really interesting, and B, economically counterindicated. Just had to say that for the record. And we are out of here. The Dow up 38 today, a tenth percent. The Nasdaq down 54. That's about 0.6%. S&P 500 basically flat. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Stephen Bion, Danielle Chiraguayo, Joanne Griffith, Annika Houston, Ben Hethcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Star Nieves is the executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.